Did we see the ARC winner at Longshaw last weekend? Who will win the ledger at Doncaster this weekend? More crisis for British racing and the gambling sector. And please, please, please stop moaning about Constitution Hill. All that and more in this week's front page. Yeah, so tons to talk about this week with myself, Lee Mottershead, and my Racing Post colleague, Chris Cook. And we are going to start in Paris on Sunday. Yesterday, we had the trials card for the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe, the Vermeil, the Niel and the Foix. And it was in the latter race for older horses that we got to see last year's ARC winner, Darriz, who faced three rivals, two of whom were really no-hopers, one of whom wasn't. Bay City Rollers, so Imperius on testing ground in the Coronation Cup. But Chris, against Darriz on a surface that was much quicker in the end than had been billed the day before the race took place, Darriz was far too good, cruising in behind Bay City Roller and then just swamping in for pace.
Yeah, very much as you would have expected it, you know, had we all known the ground was going to be as quick as it was. It was quick, wasn't it? I mean, they got a course record time in the Moulin. The Vermeil was the fastest Vermeil we've ever had.
Yeah.
You know, this is good to firm ground.
And I suppose it was soft the day before.
I mean, French going descriptions, you know, there's nothing in racing that you have to worry about more than those. I people are getting enthusiastic about Darriz. I see some bookmakers have trimmed his price for the ARC. I mean, they've got to be having a laugh, haven't they? We learned nothing about this horse yesterday other than the fact that, you know, he's alive and well. He had one horse to beat, which was a Mudlark running on a fast surface. Take Darriz out of that race, I would fancy you or me to beat Bay City Roller in those circumstances.
Well, now you say that, and now I just to put the other point of view, I suppose you could say Darriz was 5-2, 11-4 before the race. He's still 9-4 after the race. He showed that the Ascot run was a blip because he was really, but
not,
also
not even a blip, it was fine.
Absolutely, it was fine. But he was very impressive against bittier horses, but on the soft, the softer ground. But I suppose what made me think that bookmakers might go even shorter than 9-4 was that you looked at the other two trials. Did they produce a screaming obvious arc winner? I'm not sure they did.
It's not that sort of year, I don't think.
No, really. I just wonder if the opposition is already falling by the wayside and whether Darriz on the day could be a fair bit shorter, but you think not?
Well, he might be. It depends what happens between now and then. I was thinking on my way into the studio this morning, 9-4 about the ARC favourite, literally 27 days before the race.
Yeah.
You don't know what the opposition is going to be, don't know what the ground is going to be.
Or the draw.
And he really, I mean, if he ends up in stall 17, how do you feel about taking 9-4 then?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I was trying to think, is there a horse I can remember in the past 40 years that I would gladly have taken 9-4 for the ARC a month before the ARC? I mean, I couldn't really think of one. I mean, maybe Enable the second time.
Okay.
But, I mean, you know, in those circumstances where there's so much you don't know, I think you have to respect the race. It's always so competitive. It's a hard race to win. Darriz is trying to be the first male to win it twice since the 70s. I appreciate it's not often tried.
Yeah.
The time in that pre-foire yesterday, or pre-foire, I think you said.
It's become the foire, hasn't it?
Okay.
The pre-foire,
I'm trying to be a bit more French. The pre-foire, okay.
The pre-foire.
That race that Darriz won, that was 5 seconds slower than either the Vermeil or the Niel. He's proved nothing. As I say, except that he's alive and well. So you've got, you know, decent horses potentially coming up against him in that race. Like Kalpana and Item and, you know, just a bunch of others, Thundering On if it comes up mud, and a few others that would have to be taken into consideration then. I just think that when you get there, if you've taken 9-4 a month beforehand, you're going to start getting the jitters.
Okay, I'm more enthusiastic, but we're not going to grow on everything. I think he's very much the one to beat, and I think he's going to be the best horse in the field, and I also think he's pretty adaptable ground-wise. I mean, that was quick ground yesterday. We know he goes on softer ground, albeit some of the horses he might meet on softer ground will be bigger dangers, including the horse he beat on Sunday. But again, I just thought, looking at the ARC trials as a whole, I mean, the Niel, well, for start, we're going to talk about your views on the current state of Ballydoll and the horses later in the show.
Okay.
But Varandir beats Alam with Benvenuto Cellini flopping, looking a horrible ride, actually, in the L with the way he hung up the home straight.
Yeah.
And then the Vermeil Friendly Soul now gets into the arc, but is she really an arc winner? Maybe suddenly the horse who finished third for Graffard and Joe Mark, maybe more of a contender. But did you see anything in those two other arc trials that you thought that is a genuine arc contender?
No, but then I remember on Friday looking at the runners in those arc trials and thinking, you know, I'm not sure that I see anything in here, you know, really including Dorise, that I'm expecting to sort of to come out and make me think that's the arc winner. There's not such a runner in the arc trials every year. You know, you can't just expect that you can watch the racing on this weekend and know what's going to happen a month later. So, the Vermeer, I think, is normally quite a good place to go because fillies have got such a great record in the arc in recent years. You know, they get that allowance, which is so helpful. Friendly Soul, you have to respect. I mean, she's won a couple of Group 1s now at the track and now over the course and distance of the arc.
She's surely not an arc winner, though, is she?
I mean, I think she was helped by... So it wasn't a plan to go off in front. It was sort of enterprising tactics on Sunday there, but I think it really helped her. I mean, you know, on fast ground, if you get a soft lead and you can just sort of pinch a little cushion at a vital stage in the race, you can really make it hard for the others to catch you as long as you don't stop. And that seemed to be what happened. And she was clinging on a little bit at the end. You know, those tactics are not going to play in an arc, are they?
No.
As you say, suddenly the third looked unlucky. But whether she would go for the arc, considering, you know, Graffard's already got at least two others that
although
she's going to
run. In different connections. Judmont-Philly.
She is Judmont, and they also have at least
Calpan
two others
item,
that might go for the arc. So I just think that, you know, everybody's already got a full hand. And they might try and win something else with her. Maybe she'll stay in training, who knows?
But yeah,
she's very talented.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? And before we move on from Longchamp, we also had the Prix du Moulin yesterday, now stayed an Arc Trials card, in which Stade appeared to have a great chance of ending his run of secondaitis, but he actually ended up finishing third behind another Aga Khan Graffard winner, Erdenali, and 10 Bob Tony. What are your thoughts on that race?
So, Opera Bala was in there, was he fourth as well? So, that race brings together quite a lot of strong mile form from the year so far. You have to respect it. Erdenali looks like, you know, a classic young French horse who's been brought along really patiently and gradually, and just, you know, suddenly we're seeing what he's capable of. He's undoubtedly good. I feel a bit sorry for Gstaad. I mean, you say secondaitis, but he's kept getting beat by the same horse.
A very, very good horse.
And we all, you know, we're so impressed with Bow Echo. And, you know, every time Gstaad is kind of there, not far behind him. But I don't know if his reputation has sort of been ballooning at the same rate. I started the year loving him for the Guineas. I couldn't believe the way he got kicked aside that day. I think he's shown since then he's a really quality horse. And I wanted him to take advantage of this opportunity, and it didn't quite happen. There was some suggestion, I think, in one of the reports that he had a cut after the Sussex Stakes, so he's maybe taken a bit of time to recover from that. Might have needed this run. My instant reaction was that maybe actually he needed a break because he's danced every dance so far this year, hasn't he?
Yeah.
One way or another, you know, whether it's either of those, you can imagine him having a valid excuse. It'd be interesting to see where they turn up next. I'd be hoping he'd be the kind of horse that they might want to keep in training for next year. You know, he's got a bit of size to him. You know, you could really see him doing some damage in the mile division next year, or sort of stepping up maybe to 10 furlongs. I mean, he was finishing strongly, having got outpaced on Sunday. So, you know, maybe he does need to go up and trip.
It was interesting too that in the week in which the European Patent Committee ratified France Gallo's request for the arc to be open to geldings next year, we had a Prix du Moulin in which Stade was beaten by two geldings, Erdenali and 10 Bob Tony. And does anyone think those two horses didn't deserve to finish first, second over him? Does anyone think that they weren't just better horses on the day? I'd be surprised they did. I love the whole geldings in the art thing. But again, I don't think their performances relative to Stade should be downplayed because they were geldings, which the argument against putting geldings in the arc would seem to me to suggest they should be.
Yeah, I basically agree with you, but, you know, what a can of worms you've just tipped all over the conversation. I mean, I know from, you know, letters I've had that there are some readers out there who just don't like
Cuttles, absolutely.
The amount of gelding that goes on, and they talk about the artificial advantage that gives because those horses are easier to train. And, you know, they'd much rather see, you know, some of our top races confined to colts, because those are the ones that, you know, you're relying on to breed the next generation. So there you go. I mean, arguably, that's another reason for feeling sorry for Gestad.
Yeah, well, go on then. I'll give you that one. Another great gelding, the greatest gelding in the world, the greatest racehorse in the world, perhaps the greatest sprinter of all time, was in action again at Sharton on Sunday. Kai Ying Rising was imperious, running from the front in a handicap, breaking his own track record at Sharton, in fact, smashing the track record. He now goes on to Sydney to bid for a second win in the Everest. We also had Sadad giving Jack Mitchell a first Group 1 success in the Grosser Prize from Baden on Sunday. But returning to the subject of geldings, Chris, perhaps the most famous gelding in our part of the world was competing at Kempton on Saturday in the September Stakes. Constitution Hill.
Good link.
Thank you. Now, the misery guts in racing, and there are a few, were complaining about the coverage he was getting before his run in September. So I cannot understand why.
Just join in the party.
Absolutely, it's
guys.
Great for the sport. It was perhaps disappointing he not only didn't win, but he didn't get in the first three, because firstly, he would have got him into the Melbourne Cup, or would have qualified him for the Melbourne Cup. But he travelled like a dream, I thought, through the race.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And for me, he was tap for toe up the home straight. Perhaps he needed the run. That was Nick Jensen's, one of his things he inferred from the performance. But he posted a Racing Post rating of 109 behind Pride of Arras, Gethin and Warrant Holder. And I thought for a third flat run, for a nine-year-old, I thought that was actually a really encouraging effort.
Yeah, I mean, he's coming back from a gap of, you know, I don't know how many months. He was fully entitled to need the run. And as you say, against quality rivals, it was weird to me, you know, the extent to which he was really backed going into that race, you know, because he had so much to prove on the ratings.
Massive amount.
I can't remember a horse like it for the amount of faith shown in circumstances where you can't quite see the reason for it. It reminded me of Nick Morden's old theory about, you know, the number of mentions a horse gets in the papers. He said any anti-post race, you count up the number of mentions each horse gets relative to each other, you could nearly calculate the odds that they are from the number of mentions.
How interesting.
But there's the whole chicken and egg thing. You know, is there that amount of coverage for each horse because they're favourite or second favourite, or third favourite? Or do they become favourite, second favourite because they're getting loads of mentions anyway? That was his theory, was that the coverage largely determines that the odds that these horses end up. And Constitution Hill gets a lot of coverage. But, you know, that's not just because the media loves him. You know, it's largely because every time we write a story about him, there's huge interest.
Completely.
You know, he's a real public horse. And so, you know, to that extent, it's great to have him. To that extent, I turn into John Gosden. And as you say, he's run a perfectly good race. I think there's sort of evidence in that race for both camps, isn't there? I mean, if you're dead against him running on the flat, you might say, well, the only horse he's beaten was the only horse in the race that was older than him, who was giving him weight, and he's beaten him by that much. But I think really, as you say, it's a career best from him on the flat in adverse circumstances. If you find another race for him where there's going to be a more of an end-to-end gallop, maybe a proper test of stamina at a mile four, mile six.
Perhaps on turf with a bit of give in the ground?
Well, exactly that. I mean, they must have been thinking, wishing that they'd gone to Windsor the week before because, you know, the rain did come in the end and that might have been quite a good spot for him. This was a tough race and he's done okay.
I think so too. And I think if you get to that race and you said, could you conceive of this horse winning a listed race or even a Group 3 on the flat or a very valuable handicap on what could be a decent mark depending on how he gets assessed tomorrow, I think you'd say yes. And I'd also say, Chris, that coming just after the desperately sad news that Galopin des Champs had died so early in retirement, those people who say retiring, we had a reminder there that racehorses, sadly, they are kamikaze creatures who can get just as easily injured in a field as in a race. And I also think this argument that it's demeaning for Constitution Hill to be running on the flat at that level. I have yet to meet a racehorse who was offended by anything anyone ever said about him. And whilst I remember years back being quite sad to see the 1983 champion hurdle winner, Gay Brief, running in low-grade staying handicaps at places like Hereford, if Gay Brief was happy doing that if it was giving him a quality of life that he enjoyed doing,
yep.
then who are we to say? You know, race horses aren't bothered about protecting their legacies. It's all, when we say we don't like to see a horse running like Crunchy Shell on the flat, or when people say that, he doesn't mind. If he wakes up in the morning thinking, I can't wait to get on that gallop, I'm looking forward to having a race, why the hell shouldn't he?
I feel like you're sort of drafting your next column as we're
Do you know, it's
here.
Funny you said that this time next week, readers.
Yeah, no, it's perfectly all very good points. I mean, and there's an element to which, you know, we've all got to earn a living. He's still of a normal racing age. Why shouldn't he carry on? I think there were some people who, when he switched from hurdles to the flat, they were setting the bar unrealistically high. They were saying, you know, this is an experiment that's only worth doing if he's going to be competing in the top races. Yeah. And at the age that he was, that was never likely. And I never really fancied the idea of the Melbourne Cup either. I mean, you know, what a difficult race that would be, a challenging race, other side of the world, and he probably would get lumbered with a big weight. So it's not like he'd be, you know, going in there a few pounds light. So they can definitely find races in which you'll be competitive. You know, it might be listed Group 3 sort of level.
Yeah.
It might be a quality handicap. But, you know, there's races where he's going to show up well.
Yeah.
And as long as he can keep the game going and give us, you know, a bit of entertainment along with all the other racehorses that make up this great game, then so much the better.
Hallelujah. If we're talking about horses who won't be running again in handicaps or even in Group 3s, Chris Almirac was sensational. In the Sprint Cup of Haydock. Smallest field since Royal Applause won in 1997, but I would counter one of the most impressive performances we've seen in that race or any European Group 1 sprint for a long time.
Really, I mean, it was 9 lengths back to the third. My approach to that race was, you know, it was like a throwback Sprint Cup, wasn't it? That race always used to be on
top ground. As it used to be, completely.
And like the last 5 or 6 years it's been good or faster, very weird.
But also a throwback to having a Group 1 sprint with a relatively small but select field, which I like.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't mind the big fields, but I mean, I was taken by surprise by what he was able to do. Because I was sort of looking at it, he was a Royal Ascot winner who'd then been a bit disappointing in the July Cup. And you think, well, I mean, you know, this could be a summer horse who's, you know, just done enough for the year. But I mean, that was... a career best and then some. And it, you know, it turns out that he's a soft ground horse who's been sort of waiting to reveal himself, and he's just happened to win at Royal Ascot in spite of the ground. And the performance in the July Cup was probably, you know, because he wasn't enjoying running downhill on a quick surface.
Yeah.
You know, and so then on Saturday we've seen the real him. And I think he's the first sprinter to win 2 all-age group ones in the same year since Batash, which is
really?
6 years ago.
Yeah,
which just shows you what that division has been. You know, it's like, you know, on any day when you turn up, it could be anybody's turn. But he's really asserted himself now, and he'll go to Ascot as a strong favourite, you would think, for the Champions Day sprint, and hopefully be around next year. You know, he's a proper star, but maybe, you know, for some of us, that's going to take some of the fun out of these quality sprint races, that you can no longer just pick a 66-1 shot and hope for the best.
Yeah, they'll struggle against him. Group 1 racing is back in Britain again this weekend with the St. Ledger. We've also got the Irish Champions Festival at Leopardstown, and the Currer David Jennings will be giving us his views on the big races coming up on Saturday and Sunday soon. But before we do that, we're moving across to the situation that impacts the British racing industry in relation to what's happening in the gambling sector. Last week in Parliament, Martin Crudder spoke at a reception hosted by the Arena Racing Company and the Betting and Gaming Council that was ostensibly about the St. Ledger coming up on Saturday, but in a wider sense looked at the situation that the gambling sector is facing as a result of gambling regulation changes and linked to the fact that there is talk of a potential increase in machine games duty. Now, that was also referenced in the Times on its edition, in its edition on Monday today, with confirmation that Chancellor John Healey is looking at potentially increasing machine games duty and gambling taxes. Now, that would be bad news for British racing, but also bad news for British racing came last week with the news that Paddy Power is to close 100 more betting shops. We haven't yet heard whether those will be solely in Britain or in Britain and Ireland. And in Ireland, there are also real pressures and problems in relation to gambling regulation, as Isabel Duff found out.
Despite the news of recent betting shop closures in the UK and Ireland, most of us are very familiar with the sight of a betting shop in our high street. That actually wasn't always the case. Betting shops were only legalised in the UK in May 1961. Before that, you could only place a legal bet trackside or over the telephone. And that's all very well if you can just jump in the jag and go to the track whenever you want. But for the rest of us, anyone who's seen the Peaky Blinders will know there was a thriving underground gambling scene happening. But the 1960 Betting and Gaming Act put a stop to that. That's the UK though. And when it comes to racing and good times in general, my people, the Irish, are always a couple of lengths ahead. In 1926, the Free State, as it then was, allowed for the creation of state-regulated betting offices with a 5% excise duty. That means Ireland has been reaping the rewards of gambling levies for 100 years. That law had to be adjusted in 1931 in order to curb perceived excesses. And the idea here was to limit how often and indeed who could gamble legally in Ireland. Now, this meant that shops had to be closed on Sundays, they had to be closed by 6 p.m, and they also were closed on Good Friday and Christmas Day. The other quite unusual addition was designed in order to bring more people back to racetracks because attendances had sharply fallen after the betting shops had become legalised. So this was called the payout ban. If you had placed a bet in an off-course shop, you would not get your winnings for that meeting until after the meeting had finished running. So if you needed a quick turnaround on your winnings, you were better off being down at the track than in the shop. Frequent visitors to a betting shop, and I'm going to go out on a limb here and suggest that maybe the fine readers of the Racing Post are among that population, will know there's a couple of repeatable formats within a betting shop. You've got the same old faces, you've got your multiple screens, you've got the little pens, and in the majority, you're also going to have kind of dark or blacked out windows. And that's because when the first law to legalise betting shops in the UK came into place, they specifically wanted to make betting shops as uninviting and drab as possible in order to discourage people from gambling. Now, as we all know, that didn't work. But at the time, you were not even allowed to have chairs in the bookies, lest anyone get too comfortable when placing their bets. The final major change that made betting shops kind of what we know them today was the legislation that allowed live TV to be shown in betting shops. Before that, you had to rely on the radio or results being wired in from the track. Someone would then come out, mark a board. This was first, second, third. Charming, but not so good when there's a Stewart's Inquiry at play. And over time, amidst all of these changes, bookies overcame their social stigma and now are very much a part of communities the same way your pub or a corner shop might be. Will they be able to weather this current storm, though? Well, we'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, so really interesting stuff there from Isabel back home in Ireland. In Britain, Chris, as I said at the top of that piece, this perfect storm continues to get ever more fierce. We had those betting shop closure announcements by Paddy Power. Martin Crudder spoke of a truly grave threat to British racing as a result of further increases in gambling taxation. And then today we had this report in the Times that John Healy, the quote was, increases in gambling taxes are definitely on the table, one government source told the Times, and we'd already been reporting that if there is a doubling of machine games duty from 20% to 40%, as the Social Market Foundation and former PM Gordon Brown has been advocating, we could expect to have up to 2,912 betting shops closed, according to the modelling, and that would hit levy and media rights for British racing by £70 million.
I suppose that's catastrophe levels, isn't it?
Because, that's
the numbers that you're talking about. That's nearly half of all the shops that we currently have in Britain, which is just completely at odds with the rhetoric that we hear from Andy Burnham, I'm afraid, our new Prime Minister, talking about the need to sort of clamp down on betting shops. I mean, I'm struggling to imagine how anyone with their finger on the pulse could perceive any such need. I was looking at a graph in the Race Post the other day about numbers of betting shops in Britain, going down by an average of 300 a year for about the last 6 years.
Yep.
The number of shops that we have now is like about a third of what there was when he was born in the 70s. So, you know, it's just extraordinary that anyone could portray betting shops in Britain today as, you know, as any kind of growing issue. You know, it's clearly not. The reverse is the case. I'm afraid what we're losing is a sort of very well regulated, very thoroughly regulated industry, a really thoroughly taxed industry. The tax take is going to be at risk. You know, if they try and put up taxes again and close that many shops, you know, you really might end up with a sort of situation where it's a net negative for the Treasury's take. And extremely worrying, obviously, for betting, but, you know, also by extension, you know, horse racing, which depends on these shops for a lot of income, but also for the interest that they generate in the sport. You know, they're literally a shop window on the high street for horse racing. It's very hard to estimate, you know, what kind of impact that's going to have if you know, like half of them suddenly disappear. Presumably the situation is going to spiral from there because... you know, at that point, you've got a sort of a business that used to be perfectly viable. You know, as recently as a year ago, I think that Jenningsbet were talking about, you know, we can still look to open some more shops. You know, that just seems to have, that way of looking at betting shops seems to have turned around very quickly. You know, the future is very gloomy. I thought Martin Cruddas spoke very well last week at the Houses of Parliament, just reading what he said about, you know, he was making the point very clearly to the politicians who were there, you know, about what a risk it poses if you drive up tax again on a sector that was hit quite hard last November. But judging by today's story in the Times, that doesn't seem to have been heard, that message. I mean, this sounds sort of very much like the kind of flag they float, you know, ahead of a budget, just to sort of see, generate a bit of feedback, you know, see what comes back.
Yeah.
Usually in these situations, what you end up with is a kind of scaled down version of what was mentioned, what was leaked to the papers. But it seems pretty clear that they want to tax betting again.
Well, absolutely.
And you know, just at a purely pragmatic level, they've got to find money from somewhere.
Yeah.
And this, they think, is an area where there is money, they imagine, to be got, and it's not going to affect their, you know, their votes any too much. But, you know, it should do, because what they're doing, you know, seems reckless and hard to justify.
And so Martin was referencing this when he spoke at Parliament, talking about how it almost feels as though Andy Burnham is confusing betting shops with those, what I think Martin referred to as retail arcades.
Yeah.
Those establishments that are just full of machines. But then when the Prime Minister was talking in the House last week, he spoke about taking tougher action on those adult gaming centres, but he also referenced other gambling venues. So which would suggest that he absolutely understands that betting shops are part of, if you like, the line of attack that the government is going down. Now, I noticed that in that event in Parliament last week, one of the people in the room was Sally Jameson, who is the MP that has Doncaster Racecourse in her constituency. She's been a vocal supporter of racing and gambling in the last few years. She's now a Cabinet Office Minister. So I thought it was interesting that she went into that room knowing that Martin would have words of criticism for the PM, but she still was there. So I suppose my hope was that she'd go out of that room and report back to Andy Burnham. Right. Look, this is what racing's point of view is. Now, that might not happen. It might be that she hasn't got the PM's ear on this one, but we know that he's a fan of Sally Jameson. She was an enthusiastic supporter of his in his campaign to become Labour leader. So I think at the moment we're sort of all clinging to little bits of hope, and that was one of the bits of hope that I have been clinging on to, but as yet it's not shown any benefits.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to think that there might be a conduit to get racing's position to him. But I fear he's sort of painted himself into a corner with his public rhetoric on this subject. You know, it's going to be hard for him to roll back now. Mm. I mean, we did see last year that there can be a difference between the ideas that get floated ahead of the budget and then one actually turns up in the day. So, you know, there's always hope until there isn't. But the betting industry feels like it's in a really beleaguered position right now. And therefore, I'm afraid that must count for racing too.
And a good reminder of the importance of the betting sector to British horse racing comes again on Saturday when Betfred completes its sponsorship of this year's five British classics by backing the Betfred St Ledger. And Chris, you had a really interesting take on the St Ledger and also the recent performances of some Ballydoll trained runners in your front runner email this morning.
I'm somebody who's always sort of looking at the relative performance of the big name trainers. It only makes sense to me. None of them maintain their form at the same level all the way through the season. You think that their horses are following a similar training regime, so fluctuations in the sort of performance level might be an insight into things that you can't know about normally. So it just struck me that Aidan O'Brien had such a great time through May, June, July. I think they won 14 Group 1s in those 3 months. The Phoenix Stakes, which is nearly a month ago now, was their most recent Group 1 success. And things have just dried up a little bit in their sort of group races that they've tackled since then. We saw again over the weekend, you know, horses like Benvenuto Cellini, Causeway, Gestad even, you know, running just a little bit below market expectations. And it was a bit the same at York. So, you know, this might be a time when, given that the market just so loves Aidan O'Brien's first string in any race where they turn up, this might be quite a good time to be looking at taking some of them on. You're going into a weekend now when Aidan is going to have, you know, classy representatives in all these quality races at Donny and Leopardstown on Saturday, the Curragh again on Sunday. I get the impression that there's not many people like me out there sort of fretting over, you know, are they not in peak condition right now? There's always a lot of Ballydoyle fans, and you know, like I say, the price on these horses gets hammered. So, if you happen to think that things aren't going perfectly well for them at any given moment, you're sort of put in a position, I think, where you have to try and oppose them and find something to beat them. Which takes me to Christmas Day in the Ledger, 7-4. I just feel it's very short price for that horse, considering. Derby winner, you know, I always respect the Derby winner. I want the Derby to do well, and therefore you want the winners to carry on and represent. But it was, you know, he got his conditions that day. You know, there's a lot of rain. He hasn't had that since. He's been beaten a couple of times. There's some quality animals taking him on. I appreciate stepping up in distance is going to help him. But I just think he's a shorter price than he deserves to be, and, you know, he's certainly one of Aidan's that I'll be trying to get beat this weekend.
So Chris has got concerns about Christmas Day as favourite for the St Ledger on Saturday. I wonder what David Jennings thinks.
Yeah, I think plenty of people will be taken on Christmas Day, Chris. I can certainly see your point. I was of the opinion that Enceladus was my main fancy for the race for quite a while. But you know what? The more I digest it, the more I go into it, the more I listen to Aidan O'Brien, the more I think Christmas Day will actually win, for a couple of different reasons. First of all, the ground is obviously going to be, I don't know, there's going to be a cut in it anyway. So that's going to bring him into his own Christmas Day. He's still a Derby winner. And I spoke to Aidan O'Brien before the Voltigeur. And I think in the last couple of years, Aidan has been using the Voltigeur as a proper prep. I know we talk about prep races throughout the season, but it seems the Voltigeur is your ultimate prep, as in they're just ready to start back. They've had their breaks after the Derbies and all that. He had Pierre Bernard on Christmas Day in it this year, but they're just ready to start back and they're going to come on a ton for that. So it's a real stepping stone. Did it last year, doing it this year. I think Christmas Day will win. I do. I didn't think 2 weeks ago, but I do. I think he's going to win the St Ledger. But it's obviously the Irish Champions Festival at Leopardstown and the Curragh, biggest weekend of the flat season here in Ireland. And what a weekend we have in store. Constitution River versus Item, the second installment. It's going to be spicy. I fancy Constitution River myself. I think the way the race panned out at York definitely didn't suit him to be chasing those hectic early fractions, to be in the place he did. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time the whole way, and I have a feeling he's going to reverse that form. This is Leopardstown. This is the Irish Champion Stakes. This is Aidan O'Brien's bread and butter. We saw it last year with Delacroix, who bounced back from the Judmont to win the Irish Champion Stakes in fine style. I think this guy is better than Delacroix, and I think Constitution River will win the Irish Champion Stakes. Obviously, Blue Bolt is a warm order for the matron. She's just turned inside out this season. I think she's going to take the world a beating. And on the same card, I would say nearly the horse I'm most excited to see all weekend, including all the runners in the Judmont, I absolutely adore Purview from the Dermot Weld Yard. Now, I interviewed Colin Keane for an interview in the Racing Post on Monday, and Colin he's a great guy, lovely guy. He just speaks normally. It's like you're chatting to your next door neighbour, just no airs and grace about him. Doesn't talk up to horses too much. But when I asked him about Purview, he was like, this guy would blow you away in the mornings, he said. He is a phenomenal workhorse. He's always said it. And it's just your typical Dermot Weld, patient approach, gradually getting there. No rush, calm down, no rush. He's still got all season. And Dermot Weld is planning his whole season towards the Breeders' Cup turf at Keeneland. He's got a massive chance in that, especially when you see kind of Benvenuto Cellini, the way he ran on Sunday. I think Purview is a beast. And he's running the Kiltiernan Stakes. It's going to be a very, very, very short price, I'd say. But I can't wait to see him. I think he's dynamite. So Purview, for me, is going to have a cracking end to the season, I think. Looking forward to him on Saturday as well. And in the opening race, again, another Judmont owned horse, Moira Rua. Hard for you to pronounce in England, but Moira Rua, an Irish name for Ger Lyons and Colin Keane and the Inga Bell, the camp have a really good record in this race. I think Moira Rua is much better than she showed at Cork last time. She was clattered coming out of stalls, and I think she'll win the Inga Bell, the opener on Champions Weekend, or Champions Festival as it is now at Leopardstown. Moving on to Sunday, and obviously the big race on Sunday is the Irish St. Ledger. And funny sort of a race this year. Like, Scandinavia, I presume, is going to run, and he just wins, doesn't he? Like, it's very hard to make case for any of the rest of them because he's just different class. So I presume he's going to run. And I know Mile and Six is probably at the short end of his spectrum as regards stamina, but he won the St. Ledger last year at Doncaster. And I think he's a much better horse now. I think he's by far the best there in training. So obviously it will be Scandinavia in that. Now, the National Stakes is quite interesting at 4 o'clock because you've got Giant Sequoia, who's a bit of a talking horse, but on the track, he's looked grand, very good. I wouldn't say exceptional. So it's going to be interesting to see what Giant Sequoia does. Really like Desert Castle. I know he was well touted prior to his debut at Newmarket back in August. He's a brother to Dreamcastle, of course, and just looked a big, strong, powerful individual. And I think Desert Castle can give Godolphin and Charlie Appleby another big win in the National Stakes. The Meigler, all about Aidan O'Brien, of course, who has such a terrific record in the Meigler. Sun Goddess is favoured at the moment. It's hard to know what he's going to run at the moment. I would say potentially whatever he does run will be a very warm order. Whether he decides to run Alpha or Sun Goddess, it's going to be very interesting. The Flying Five is at 3:25, and I thought Time for Sandals was very, very unlucky in the Nunthorpe, and I think it could be a strike for Britain in the Flying Five for Harry Eustace. I think Time for Sandals could win the Flying Five. It's going to be cracking weekend at Leopardstown and the Curragh. I can't wait. Hope to see you there.
Thanks, DJ. Yeah, interesting stuff there, Chris, with DJ looking ahead to Doncaster, Leopardstown and the Curragh. But one of the things he picked up on there, pointed out, was in relation to the sort of ground we can expect at Doncaster on Saturday in the Ledger. DJ expecting, by the sounds of it, pretty testing conditions. That's not necessarily a given.
No, I mean, weather's very changeable this time of year.
Isn't it?
And like yesterday when I was looking at the forecast for Donny, there was some rain around, but that seems to have just dribbled out the forecast. To me, it looks like the weather this week in Doncaster is going to be mostly drying conditions. You know, there's going to be quite a bit of sun, not much rain. I think it's good to soft this morning, but I mean, given the forecast, you could easily see it drying out to good by the time you got the Ledger on Saturday, which again is really not what you want if you're taking 7-4 about Christmas Day. I think you'd probably want it soft to maximise his chance. And like I say, my instinct is his lack of speed is going to make him vulnerable.
Yeah. We'll find out on Saturday who wins the St. Ledger. On Friday at Doncaster, they have a big industry event where Martin Griddas brings together key industry leaders. And one of the things they'll be talking about is likely to be a subject that I discuss in a special report that's coming up digitally on Monday evening and then in Tuesday's newspaper, namely the Jockey Club's decision to quit the Racecourse Association, British Racing's umbrella industry group for racecourses. And a quick plug for that piece, it looks at the potential ramifications for the Jockey Club, for the racecourse sector and for British racing as a whole if the Jockey Club does indeed quit the Racecourse Association and takes away its almost £500,000 funding of the RCA. And it also looks at how the current racecourse membership of the BHA, which is at the moment conducted through the Racecourse Association, having three of the six shares in the BHA, could be replaced by direct racecourse membership / ownership of British Racing's governing body. So that is digitally on the Racing Post platforms and in Tuesday's Racing Post. We've discussed a lot in this week's programme. Chris Cook has more than earned his non-existent fee for appearing on this programme. Chris, just finally, who wins a ledger?
I think probably Enceladus, the second favourite. Joseph O'Brien, having a great year, is going to get better.
Okay, well, that is Chris looking forward to the St. Ledger. We'll be looking back on the Ledger in next week's show and no doubt much more besides. Until then, bye-bye.